Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Practical Perspectives, as today our faculty is going to review actual cases from clinical practice of endometrial cancer. We're thrilled today to have Dr. Katie Moore from the Stephenson Cancer Center at the University of Oklahoma in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and Dr. Matt Powell from the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri. Today, we're going to be talking about endometrial cancer, and as with many of our programs, well, all of them really, we will be talking about the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens. So check out the package inserts for more information. As we've been doing a lot since the pandemic, today we're going to be making rounds with our faculty. We have a bunch of community-based medical oncologists and gynecologic oncologists. They sit down with me all the time and go through cases. I had a great case today I'm going to tell you about, actually, in addition to these that we're going to see here on video. Here's where we're heading. Mainly, we're going to go through these cases, but we're also just going to sort of chat, take a look at some papers and recent publications, but really mainly make rounds. So I want to just take a breath before we get started and just kind of reflect back to the faculty. And I didn't even tell them we were going to talk about this, but I'm curious what they think, which is kind of a pan-tumor perspective on MSI-high disease, and particularly the issue of immunotherapy and localized disease. And let me tell you why I'm thinking of this. So the first question, and Katie, I'm going to ask you to start out on this. This is the interview I did today with Dr. Mulheron for the AON meeting. And as you know, all the cases, it's really amazing. And I sit down with these docs and they present CLL, lung cancer, endometrial cancer, myeloma, et cetera. And this afternoon, he did present a very interesting case, Katie, of a woman with MSI-high metastatic disease who got treated with dostarlimab and chemotherapy, carboplatin. And to his surprise, the patient didn't do too well. You know, relapsed after 7 months, really didn't respond too well. It's interesting, the TMB was low, incidentally, even though she was MSI deficient. And they actually retested, you know, to make sure. And yet they retested her, and she was MSI high. And that leads to my question. What I really wanted to pick your brain, both of your brains, about is how MSI plays out in GYN cancers, particularly endometrial cancer, compared to other cancers that we talk about all the time, particularly colorectal cancer. So, and one of the docs in one of the cases you'll hear later, Katie, brings up the question of, do people with MSI-high disease and endometrial cancer respond as well as people, say, with colorectal cancer, where we see a lot of path CRs, the neoadjuvant therapy. We see people with metastatic disease who go 2-3 years and they're not relapsing, et cetera. I hear cases like that all the time. Indirectly, Katie, do you feel that MSI-high disease and endometrial cancer is as responsive, for example, as colorectal cancer to IOs?
I think that is the correct question. And the answer is we don't know yet. And my suspicion is probably not, as maybe Matt's going to disagree with me. But we don't know yet. There are two studies that have completed. We're waiting for them to read out that were only done in deficient mismatch repair tumors, and they randomized patients to either immunotherapy alone, no chemo, or unfortunately the wrong control arm, which is just chemo and not chemo IO, just because of how the studies were launched and approvals came out. But it will help us see the activity of IO alone in that population, even if the comparison isn't as robust as we would like. We are going to be able to see if we have the same amount of patients with complete responses. These are all patients with metastatic disease as we get with chemo IO, and we'll get a sense of if the cure fraction, you know, we think that a large fraction of patients with metastatic or recurrent disease who got chemo IO are cured at least out to 3 years. They are not looking like they are recurring. We'll see with long-term follow-up. So we're going to have to really see. There's only small studies to date that have looked at this, and you do see responses. But the pathologic CRs, at least when it's been used in patients that are going to the OR for hysterectomy, don't seem to be as high as what we saw like in the Nietzsche study, and that was ipi-nivo, but a similar idea. So maybe the uterus is a bit of a kind of a sanctuary site. So I don't know yet. I don't know that it's the same. And I think we've got to wait for the data.
Wanted to bring up another issue. I would like to hear what you think about the question I asked Katie, but I also want to ask you about this. So this is we did this program last Saturday with the Florida Cancer Special. You've been doing this for many, many years. And we did a program with Dr. Liu and Dr. Strickler on colorectal. And of course, half the time we spent talking about IOs and MSI disease. And in particular, what we talked about a lot on Saturday was using it with localized disease. Katie, you were talking about, you know, the path CRs that you see. And of course, we saw that first with the dostarlimab and rectal cancer, the incredible results. And they, on Saturday, were talking about very exciting results with colon cancer. And then we went and looked up to see what was going on in terms of localized disease and endometrial. We saw this paper presented at SGO, use a phase 2 study in nivolumab, a lot of CRs that were reported. I think only 15 patients there. And also this study that a lot of people haven't heard about, which is you guys actually did an adjuvant study of IO and MSI high disease. It was a small study, but you know, the impact is so great with MSI that you actually saw, you know, a benefit. And actually before, you know, at ASCO, we had the big colon adjuvant trial, but you guys had done it already. So another example of, but then here we found all these studies that are ongoing, adjuvant and neoadjuvant and endometrial cancer. So Matt, I'm curious, again, in general, how often do you see people who, you know, go a couple years and they're free of disease? And do you think at some point or even soon, we're going to, just the way they are in colon cancer, and rectal cancer, we're going to be seeing IOs for MSI high localized disease?
Yeah, certainly something we're trying to study more. And as you pointed out, some of the studies, we've completed one here at WashU a few years ago, you know, small studies that were hypothesis generating. You know, one of the big difference between endometrial cancer and colorectal cancer is promoter methylation of the MLH1 gene drives a lot of the endometrial cancer MSI status. And that is maybe a little more heterogeneous and a little more transient than those that had a single gene driver or a Lynch syndrome driver, like a lot of the colorectal cases. And that we've looked at that. Is that a predictor of a failure in GYN? And it hasn't been consistent. There's certainly a trend that those with promoter methylation maybe don't do quite as well, but it hasn't really been borne out. And lastly, I would say that this patient that was shown, the initial patient, was a dual classifier, had a P53 mutation as well. And we usually think of those as kind of a passenger-like mutation, but they actually may be a little more of a driver in this situation. So it has been looked at in a few of our early looks at this, that those that have both MMR deficiency and P53 mutation may do more poorly.
Really interesting. We may bring this back up as we go through these cases, because we have a lot of cases where we have questions about IOs. And we're going to start out with such a case. And again, this is a patient with MSI high metastatic disease who was treated with dostarlimab and chemotherapy. Here's Dr. Pelez.
On CT imaging, she had evidence of metastatic disease. So she had actually a right pelvic soft tissue mass, retroperitoneal pelvic adenopathy, and a number of pulmonary nodules that were consistent with metastases. So I started her on paclitaxel, carboplatin, and dostarlimab. She achieved a complete remission. She now remains on dostarlimab, still in complete remission. So questions here would be to review the data with paclitaxel, carboplatin, dostarlimab. This patient has MMR deficiency. Do you use dostarlimab in patients who are MMR proficient as well, based on the data? And then in terms of continuing the dostarlimab in a patient like this who clearly had metastatic disease, do you stick with the study schema where I believe they continued for 3 years? Would you consider continuing therapy beyond that? What about somebody who's maybe not in complete remission? Would you keep them on the immunotherapy drug for longer? And then what would you do with her, you know, when she relapses? How would you approach the next line of therapy for her? Is chemotherapy really necessary here? You know, we have such great results and data in GI malignancies with immunotherapy alone. Does she need the chemotherapy? If she was instead of 60, if she was 80, would you give her chemotherapy or potentially just give her the checkpoint inhibitor?
So, Matt, this is like a memory test to see if you can remember all the questions that he just asked. And I'll throw in one other. Another thing we talked about on Saturday, you know, is ipi-nivo is there in MSI-high metastatic colon cancer. So that's another question, even in a patient like this who, if they were to relapse. So let's start out with the issue of duration of IO and also choice of IO, dostarlimab and pembrolizumab, Matt, being the common choices, and what you do. And a patient who has a CR, how long do you keep it going? Would you use cell-free DNA, for example, to decide?
Yeah, great unanswered questions. On the Ruby trial, we had up to 3 years of therapy. And if you still had disease at the end of that time, you could elect to stay on therapy. And the reality is a lot of these patients, kind of get into that Q6-week regimen. They're doing pretty well. And, it's hard. They're excited about being on it and not wanting to stop, especially if they're not having side effects. We don't have a great experience on what to do with circulating tumor DNA. It certainly makes sense. There's a little bit of data from Shannon Weston's study looking at circulating tumor DNA within that study, and we'll probably be touching on that later on. But I don't use it clinically at this point. I think typically using traditional CT scan and following these patients as was done on the trial. Lastly, he mentioned a little bit about should we use just the checkpoint alone? And that's a question that, as Katie mentioned, we have a few studies that are maturing that looked at checkpoint versus chemotherapy. Those won't completely answer it, but we'll kind of get an idea from those studies about, the Dominica study will kind of help us with dostarlimab, whether, how well does that perform as just checkpoint alone. The you mentioned that 80-year-old patient, I probably would think about just checkpoint alone in somebody that's rather compromised and trying to avoid chemotherapy. But at least for right now, the standard would be to give them both.
So, Katie, I'm going to let you take a look at this next case, which is very similar. It's another patient with a CR, a chemo IO, in this case, pembrolizumab. So just hold your thoughts about these questions, and let's hear what Dr. Divers has to say.
In the spring of this year, she had recurrent biopsy-proven disease in the omentum. We evaluated her for a clinical trial, but she was not a candidate. She was placed back on carboplatin taxol and pembrolizumab. She subsequently had a CR based on imaging. Intriguingly, none of her CA125 or CEA or other markers were ever elevated during this process.
So what questions do you have about her?
Given the BRCA mutation, we have lots of data in ovarian, but I'm not familiar with any data regarding the role of a PARP inhibitor in a patient like this in an endometrial setting. And so what might the role be in the endometrial space? What would be the expected duration of the Pembro? What other thoughts would you have? Would you have chosen anything other than the platinum and Taxol, as she was very close to the 6-month window for prior therapy? I'm unaware of any data with ipi-nivo, but I would love to see what people's thoughts would be about the use here in this MSI space. And I really don't understand the biologic difference between why you see less robust of a response in this endometrial space than we see perhaps in the colorectal space and others.
So, Katie, Dr. Diver is the one who kind of brought this idea up about how effective the treatment. So we'll talk a little bit later on about DuoE, but now we're talking about a patient who's got a BRCA1 mutation. Katie, how do you think that through? Would you try to integrate a PARP inhibitor? And again, the same question as the first case, how long do you treat?
Well, this patient in particular has already received paclitaxel, carboplatin, pembrolizumab, and progressed. So she had a CR.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Okay, so she had a CR.
So
she's fine. So the question is, would I use a PARP in the future? Or would I have done something differently at the beginning?
Yeah. How do you deal with a patient even from the beginning? Would you have done the same thing up front in management, or would you have integrated a PARP inhibitor?
I would not have integrated a PARP inhibitor in this patient with MSI high. I would like to know her. I assume she's deficient mismatch repair, but DuoE actually, we'll talk about this. DuoE had both deficient and proficient mismatch repair. In the deficient mismatch repair population, the PARP added nothing. And it may just be numeric, but we saw fewer complete responses in the population that received PARP. And that does biologically make some sense that there may be some antagonism there. So I would not have used a PARP inhibitor in this patient. I know it sounds like blasphemy because of the BRCA, but in a DMMR tumor, I would not have added PARP here. So I think he did exactly the right thing in this setting. Yeah.
So we have several cases of MS stable metastatic disease, but first I want to just take a look at some of the data. Matt, maybe you can just kind of, you know, the two major trials that we're looking at here, NRG as well as the RUBY study. Here's the NRG data. Matt, anything you want to say in terms of the impact that was seen there based on MSI status?
So, yeah, so you see a deeper response, a more sustained response in that DMMR population with that hazard ratio 0.3. And these were initially presented with pretty premature data. There was quite a bit of crossover to getting a checkpoint afterwards. And so you see that OS isn't as significant here as you might have thought, and that's because a lot of the patients went on to get checkpoint later here in the United States. When you look at the PMMR, certainly less robust. But the other important thing about GY018, each of the cohorts were independently powered, which I think on the subsequent publications, you see a little more robust data on the OS. Now, as far as RUBY, I was the study chair in the U.S. for this, and obviously it's been a labor of love. It has a few differences. It involved carcinosarcomas, and those patients with positive periodic disease also could be included. They were randomized up to 3 years of the dostarlimab maintenance, but otherwise a very similar study. When you look at these data on the next slide, you see the DMMR cohort again, very robust difference in the progression-free survival, a little more modest in the progression-free survival for the PMMR cohort, but nonetheless similar trend. I think the next slide you have is an OS slide. We're showing OS both in these subpopulations and the entire population, the intent to treat population, ends up being clinically significant. When we dial into some of the molecular data, it also was quite intriguing that the P53 mutation patients seemed to benefit from the addition of the checkpoint. Maybe a little less robust benefit in the patients that had the NSMP or the non-specific molecular profile patients. So still, we're still learning a lot about who benefits most from this intervention. But obviously it's an exciting thing for our patients.
So, Katie, I also wanted to ask you, you mentioned the DUO-E study, and I find it personally challenging to understand, so I'm going to give you a shot at trying to explain it to me again, but maybe you can start out talking about the theoretical interaction between PARP inhibitors and immune checkpoint inhibitors.
Sure. So there have been lots of theories that we have done many trials trying to prove. But the one that really was the foundation for DUO-E is that if you induce DNA damage with any sort of therapy here, a PARP inhibitor, that it causes DNA damage, which then leads to cytosolic DNA, and that cytosolic DNA will activate the STING pathway. And if you upregulate the STING pathway, theoretically, that should make the microenvironment more conducive to bringing in an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And so you're trying to kind of make a more immunogenic environment in a setting that wasn't previously immunogenic, like a proficient or non-deficient mismatch repair sort of tumor. So that was sort of the underlying theory behind combining PARP inhibitors and immune checkpoint inhibitors across many solid tumors, including endometrial.
So can you talk a little bit about RUBY Part 2, Katie?
Sure. RUBY Part 2 and DUO-E were quite different studies in design. RUBY Part 2 was two arms, as you can see here. There's the control arm, wasn't what you would expect. You would have expected it to be the arm that contained immune checkpoint inhibitor. The control arm just had paclitaxel and carboplatin, and then placebo maintenance. And then the experimental arm was paclitaxel, carboplatin, dostarlimab, and then dostarlimab plus niraparib. And then, so comparing the two, clearly it met the primary endpoints in the overall population, which you can see on the right. And then we're particularly here looking at this non-DMMR population, which you can see here clearly superior. But we already knew this, you know, for Ruby Part 1. We knew dostarlimab was better than nothing. So what did PARP add to the dostarlimab was sort of the question that you couldn't suss out from this particular clinical trial. Here again, you see the DMMR population, which looks fantastic, but is that being driven entirely by dostarlimab, or does it have anything to do with the niraparib? That made the interpretation of that challenging. I think I'm hurting Matt's feelings, but he can. Sorry, Matt. Your study's uninterpretable. No, but we could put it in context with. That always happens. You can say that about my studies too. But then you put it in context with DUO-E, which was also not perfect. Perfect study would have had four arms. It has three arms though. So we had a similar population of advanced and recurrent with some subtle differences, although DUO-E also allowed carcinosarcoma. Chemotherapy alone with placebo maintenance. Chemotherapy with durvalumab, durvalumab maintenance. Chemotherapy, durvalumab, durvalumab, olaparib maintenance. The primary endpoint was to compare arm three, the olaparib durvalumab, to arm one, which is just chemo, and then arm two, which is durvalumab alone, to arm one. Those were the two statistical analyses. Unfortunately, we did not power what you want to know, which is arm three, durva olaparib versus durva. And so we just have kind of theories there. But here you can see the progression-free survival by mismatch repair on the left-hand side is DMMR. On the right-hand side is not DMMR. And this was my earlier point. In the DMMR, there's absolutely no signal that there's any benefit from adding the PARP inhibitor, you know, in this population. And so it should not be done, period. There's no data for it. On the right-hand side, though, there does appear to be a signal. Even though we did not power arm three versus arm two, arm three looks better than arm two when you just look at it like a normal human being. And so there still is this lingering question of whether or not it should be used in this population. Here's the overall survival, very premature. We're still waiting for the OS readout. I'm the kind of co-chair with Shannon Weston, so I can tell you that. And I think that will be telling in terms of regulatory readouts on this clinical trial.
So, Matt, I'm curious for your take about this overall issue of where PARP inhibitors fit in, if at all, in endometrial cancer at ASCO. I always love it when I start seeing the circulating DNA. We talk about that. It seems like every day nowadays they presented some data from the DUO-E study on cell-free DNA. Any thoughts about that and where you see things heading in general with PARP inhibitors and endometrial cancer, Matt?
So I certainly agree with Katie that I think PARP was underwhelming. And maybe we'll find a biomarker that finds the select group of patients that benefit from the addition of PARP. We do see some PFS differences, but I don't think we're seeing much on the OS side for the addition. And in fact, maybe even some trends towards harm if you look at some of the studies out there. So I'd be very cautious on adding PARP into these patients at this time. The ctDNA story, though, is interesting. And I think that basically what it tells us, if patients have positive circulating DMNA, they do worse. If it doesn't clear, they do worse. I don't know how much it helps us as far as stopping therapy yet, mm-hmm. Because obviously we didn't stop therapy on the trial. So we'd have to, further study as needed here. It's certainly some intriguing data. And but at this point, no on PARP and questioning on ctDNA at this point.
So one more set of studies I want to look at is lenvatinib pembro. Before we do that, though, we got a case in the chat room I want to throw out to Katie from Charles. Patient with early stage disease had a hysterectomy adjuvant treatment. 3 years later has an isolated CNS met. Not surgically resectable, but biopsy is positive. How often do you see CNS mets in endometrial cancer, either oligomets or at multiple sites? Any CNS activity of any systemic therapies, Katie?
We do see CNS metastases with endometrial cancer. I wouldn't say it's incredibly common, but it's certainly not, like, you don't wonder, like, what it is. Like, that's something that we can see. I don't know, Matt. I would say we see this maybe 5% of the time, if that. Although the good thing is our patients are living longer now because we have more active therapy. So I think we're probably going to see more mirroring breast cancer because patients are going to live long enough to actually see them. So I think it's actually going to increase. But we do see it. And many things that we use penetrate, you know, the blood-brain barrier and then the tumor-brain barrier are very different things. And so our antibody drug conjugates, which many thought wouldn't penetrate, breast cancer has shown us very clearly that TDXD penetrates the brain in a profound way for patients. And I think that's probably true of most ADCs. And so that would be kind of something that I'd be thinking about. You know, but immune checkpoint inhibitors can work there as well, as long as you don't get the swelling. And sometimes you have to counter that with different therapies, either steroids. Some people use bevacizumab around that. I would consult a neuro-oncologist before I did that. But those are very treatable. Oligomets to the brain actually can be incredibly treatable, and patients can do very well for long periods of time. Again, thinking about breast cancer, I learned from my breast medical oncologist really recently that they start with TDXD. Like, we go right to radiation in GYN. We're like, brain met, red. If you're HER2 positive, my fellow oncologist taught me this very recently. They go first to TDXD, and they, because they don't want the cognitive issues, because these patients are going to live such a long time. What a remarkable world we're living in, where that's the truth. We're going to get there. But that's how I would be thinking about it.
Yeah, I think that paradigm of holding off on radiation, to me, the first time I started hearing about it was in non-small cell lung cancer with targetable lesions like RET and EGFR, where they would use targeted therapy rather than radiation. But now you're seeing it, as you say, with ADCs. So, Matt, the other IO strategy that's been looked at, and it seems like it's settling in more, is a second-line therapy for patients who don't get it first or get an IO first in line. Is lenvatinib pembro, the Keynote 775 study, and also, and, you know, we can talk later on. We have a case of a patient who got that, about the safety issues that come up with this combination. We're going to see an update of that at the ASCO, at the ESMO meeting, and also more data from the first line situation where we didn't see as much benefit compared to chemotherapy. Matt, any comments about the current role of lenvatinib pembro?
Yeah, so I think the trial, although technically negative, it did provide us some information that it seems to be nearly equivalent to carboplatin paclitaxel, certainly different mechanism of action, gives our patients a potential option for a non-chemo regimen. Now, I wouldn't say that it's definitely less toxic, but they're different toxicities. And I think, you know, remains an option for us in certain patients where chemotherapy may be either contraindicated or refused. So the follow-up data would be anxious to see, with additional year follow-up from Dr. Marth. Looking at the abstract, it looks like it's going to be fairly similar with similar safety signal.
So let's get back to our cases here. And we have a case from Dr. Kelly Schneider. Actually, we have presented another case of, she's the only person who's presented a POLE case to me. She actually, we did this at ASCO. She had POLE metastatic disease, and guess what? She had a great response to IO. I'm sure that's no big surprise. But this is another very interesting case of a young patient, 32 years old. Here's Dr. Schneider.
This is a fascinating patient, 32, actually was undergoing infertility treatment, and ultimately she was diagnosed with Asherman syndrome because of the repeat biopsies and those sorts of things. But this went on for 3 or 4 years, despite my begging her to have a hysterectomy. She just couldn't get herself to do it. We did a hysterectomy in 2020, and tumor was overall not exciting. It was still a grade 1, did not have deep myometrial invasion, no lymphovascular space invasion, and it was MMR proficient. We were seeing her yearly for her stage 1 and developed shortness of breath, was seeing several different doctors. Ultimately, finally got a chest x-ray, showed multiple pulmonary metastases, got a PET scan, again, confirming this. As you can see in the picture, they were extensive shortness of breath. Did a CT-guided biopsy, showing a recurrence of her grade 1 cancer. I started her on paclitaxel carboplatin and pembrolizumab, and her CT scan showed significant improvement. She was no longer short of breath, really had no symptoms at all. And so she elected to just transition to pembrolizumab maintenance. My question for everybody at this point is, does everybody agree with stopping treatment? She had a very, very, very significant pulmonary disease, really have made a very large difference with chemotherapy, but she's also extremely young, healthy, and now, you know, has a 4.5-year-old at home. So obviously want to give her as much time as we possibly can. She just elected for pembrolizumab maintenance alone. And now we're a year out and she still has stable disease. The big question that I think a lot of us have in the community is, when do you recommend DOE, the DOE protocol? It gets very confusing. Do the experts recommend putting on DOE versus not? Is it everybody that's not MMR deficient?
So, Katie, any thoughts about this case? And for the medical oncologist, can you explain what Asherman syndrome is?
Asherman's, boy, you're going back in my GYN knowledge. Asherman's is when you have like scarring on the inside of the uterus, and so from repeated like DNCs and things, and so they get all these adhesions basically, and it causes infertility. Some of it's, I think, can be what's the word I'm looking for? Like people can have Asherman's without having prior trauma, but it basically is the cause of infertility based on the mechanics of the uterus. Matt, did I get that right? I had to dig for that.
You're still an OBGYN. Look at that.
I had to dig for that. Yeah. I think that this patient was treated absolutely appropriately. 100% agree with how she was managed. I 100% agree with stopping the chemotherapy with an excellent response and then transitioning to maintenance and prioritizing quality of life and being very patient centric. I referenced this earlier, the remarkable thing right now, Matt and I talk about this, many of us do that are a little bit older. You know, when we started practicing, Matt and I, we don't practice together, but at the same time, these patients had an expected 2-year survival of 30%. That's what happened. Once they recurred, nothing worked and they just died. And now we have just this whole paradigm of agents. We're not treating with chemotherapy indefinitely until we just beat people on the ground with toxic therapies. We're using these maintenance and we're getting smarter with our maintenance. I think in the future, pembro may still be what we use. We're also interested in endocrine therapies in a patient like this who's grade 1 and probably estrogen driven. There's the selinexor study that's ongoing for this sort of patient or this sort of tumor that's TP53 wild type. We'll see what that looks like. And then you can imagine using a therapy like that. And if they recur 1 or 2 or 3 years later, already we're different. We're a completely different world. We might reuse chemo. We may use immunotherapy again. We may use antibody-drug conjugates. The lifespan of our patients with this disease is on the cusp of being transformatively changed, and for the betterment of our patients. It's just a different world. And I think she was treated absolutely appropriately, and it will preserve her bone marrow so that if she does need something else, we can use whatever she needs and help her live longer.
What about her question about DOE and adding in olaparib, for example, in this MM proficient patient, Katie?
Yeah, you know, I have to say, I mean, I was the co-chair with Shannon, but I'm not using that. I just do not think without OS, the data is compelling enough to use it in every non-DMMR patient without fully understanding the downstream ramifications. If I'm not improving OS and there's a risk that I could be doing other things to bone marrow, I just think we have to really be thoughtful about throwing the kitchen sink at somebody or someone's tumor in somebody without really understanding what we're doing completely. So I have to say I'm not doing it. And I don't blame, and I'm not mad that she didn't do it. Not mad.
I see Matt shaking his head, yes, but I might ask him to comment. But first, Matt, I want you to take a look at this case. We were talking about pembro and lenvatinib. Of course, the whole issue of managing patients, if you're going to use this regimen, how to dose the lenvatinib, how to prepare patients for it. Here's a patient, like many, who had pretty significant problems, but then did well with dose reduction. Here's Dr. Safar.
We started the usual dose of unmatinib, and then she had tolerability issues, malaise, fatigue, hand foot syndrome, blood pressure. We had to dose reduce it a couple of times, but you know, she's doing well on 8 milligrams. She's on Pembro. How do the faculty approach older patients who have progressive disease yet functional? What biomarkers are they looking at in endometrial?
Could you talk a little bit about what dose of lenvatinib you started, what happened, how you reduced the dose?
I started like 12. We ran into issues with high blood pressure and a lot of malaise. She lives alone, and she was having a difficult time managing her day-to-day activities. Blood pressure became an issue. She's not very good at monitoring her blood pressure at home. She did also run into some hand-foot syndrome. Right now, she is managing it reasonably well on the 8 milligrams. The question is, of course, do they start at the full dose, or do they start a lower dose and go up? I think there is some data that potentially dose intensity correlates with a better response in endometrial. How does the faculty approach the dosing of lenvatinib? Generally, in elderly patients, should we consider a lower dose and stick with it? She's been on for a year and a half almost now with a very good response so far. Markers are stable, scans are stable. And of course, the question is, you know, whether, you know, if she has a progression on Pembrolen, you know, outside of chemo, is there anything else that we could utilize? What is the role of Pembrolen in the current landscape of treatments?
And Matt, in addition to chatting about your experience with Pembro, lenvatinib, and dosing, Nancy in the chat room wants to know, would you ever consider Pembro, lenvatinib in a patient who progressed on dostarlimab and chemo, or, you know, Pembro chemo? And I'll throw in, what about ipi-nivo? I'm not sure we commented on that, but again, in colorectal, that's first line.
Well, let me hit these in reverse order. So starting with the ipi-nivo, and actually we have a trial ongoing. GY025 is a trial looking at ipi-nivo versus nivolumab alone in DMMR endometrial cancer. And they can previously actually be treated with checkpoint. So that'll be a small cohort, but some of them could have prior checkpoint as part of their chemotherapy regimen. So we're evaluating it. We do think it's active. We've included about half the patients on that now. The second question was the dosing strategy of lenvatinib pembrolizumab. And area of controversy, certainly individualized care is really important. You know, a lot of patients, if you start them on 20, they may never want to take that drug again. Mm-hmm. Doing a lot of education prior to initiation is important. So getting the blood pressure cuff, getting their blood pressure under control before you take that first dose is important. A lot of patients, I will honestly write them for 18 milligrams and have them start at 14. So then they have a 10 and two fours to work with. I'm trying to push patients up to the 18 dose, but in reality, the vast majority, 14 is about what they can tolerate, and they end up at 10, especially when they get into, you know, 6 to 9 months of therapy. The fatigue gets to be a lot. We do try to maintain that dose density initially, and I know I try to be a purist and stick with the 20 milligrams, but rarely are you successful with that approach.
Again, I see Katie shaking her head. And this is kind of more like a tasting menu. This next case, you know, we actually did an entire 2-hour program at SGO on HER2-positive gynecologic cancers. Here, we're going to spend just one case and get your bottom line. But this is, we've been hearing more and more cases like this one. Here's Dr. Wilmot talking about her 67-year-old woman.
This is a patient who underwent an evaluation for postmenopausal bleeding and was identified to have an endometrial mass at time of hysteroscopic assessment with pathology that revealed uterine serous carcinoma. She had somatic testing, which revealed HER2 IHC3+ staining. She underwent a diagnostic laparoscopy with a plan to proceed to hysterectomy at that time, but she actually had carcinomatosis identified at the laparoscopy that was not identified on her pre-surgical CT scan. And unfortunately, with the distribution, this was not thought to be resectable to no gross residual. So the patient was subsequently started on neoadjuvant chemotherapy, utilizing a triplet regimen of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and trastuzumab. She received 4 cycles of this and then had interval surgery. Thankfully, she had excellent response to therapy. She had no gross extrauterine disease identified at the time of her surgical intervention. And pathology confirmed that she did have some residual disease within the uterus. She completed adjuvant therapy including carboplatin, paclitaxel, and trastuzumab, and then transitioned to trastuzumab maintenance. She completed 24 cycles of maintenance, but then had a scan which revealed new disease in the liver, and a biopsy confirmed recurrence of her uterine serous cancer. So she has now been transitioned to T-DXd and has received 10 cycles of therapy and is having quite good response with partial response to therapy on her scans.
How was she feeling when she started the T-DXd, and then what happened?
So when the patient was diagnosed with recurrence, she did have some mild right upper quadrant discomfort, just felt a little, quote, off. But since starting the therapy, she's done very well. She's had really no treatment-related toxicities, and her abdominal pain has resolved.
So we have a bunch of slides in the slide deck if you want to check it out, but I'd rather just hear your comments about your experience treating HER2-positive endometrial cancer, and Katie, particularly your experience with T-DXd and how you deal with tolerability issues like GI issues and also looking out for ILD.
Sure. So I'll start with experience sort of using T-DXd and treating patients with HER2-positive endometrial cancer. This is another place where I'd be interested in what Matt thinks, where I think we're going to change what we do. You know, right now with endometrial cancer, everything in the recurrent setting, patients have to have been exposed to immunotherapy before they can get, you know, some fancy new antibody drug conjugate. And that's probably okay, except in HER2-3+, where if someone received paclitaxel, carboplatin, trastuzumab, which I personally think is probably the right regimen for them, although we do have a clinical trial ongoing in the NCI called NRG-GY26 that will hopefully prove that. When they recur, do you treat them like endometrial cancer and they get LenPem? Or do you treat them like a 3+ patient with breast cancer and you go to T-DXd, which I think after Saturday here at ESMO will move to frontline, but I digress. So that's the second line. And then when that doesn't work, do you go to a TKI instead of LenPem? Do you go to neratinib? Do you go to tucatinib? This is what I'm thinking about with my patients that are HER2 3+ and 2+ amplified. At least. And I think we just have a lot to learn from our breast cancer colleagues. And then we have some trials that we need to do to really figure out how we do. Because right now we're just like getting patients IO so we can get out of the way and get to these other medications. When I use T-DXd, I think this has now been in the GYN community for long enough that we are getting acclimated to the ILD risk. We know how to manage nausea, vomiting. And I think if there's anyone that hasn't used this, it's a highly emetogenic drug. So don't wait and see how people do triple antiemetics up front. Just do it and patients will feel fine. The ILD risk is about 10 to 14%, tends to be very low grade because we're monitoring so closely for any inflammatory changes on the CT scan. And it's really that sort of education, Neil, that we have to do, that the radiologist is going to say, hey, are you worried about ILD? Look, there's some ILD here. They're going to say something like, actually, ground glass opacities waxing and waning clinically correlate, or inflammatory change clinically correlate. And if you, and the patient's fine and they feel fine and they're like, but I feel great, my tumor's shrinking. You know, it's that worry level that says, I'm going to get this worked up. Making sure you have a pulmonologist that can help you work things up and adjudicate a viral illness from ILD and, you know, get your patient back on treatment once it has been assessed and resolved. But it's that early recognition, the scanning, the holding, the steroids that we use, kind of low threshold for steroids, and the synergy with multidisciplinary care to keep patients safe. If you do that, the rates of grade 3 and higher ILD are very low, like 1% range. And I think we've communicated that to our GYN oncology community pretty effectively and quickly with the approval of this medication.
And, you know, this idea of picking ILD up when it's asymptomatic grade 1 is so key, because actually at ASCO, there was a presentation on retreatment of people who have grade 1, and looks like they generally do very well on retreatment. I want to just, so we may get back to this, but I just want to bring up another issue here, Matt. We're talking a lot about immune checkpoint inhibitors, and we could spend a whole hour talking about autoimmune complications. That's still a relevant issue. I'm going to show you a case of an interesting autoimmune complication, but just get your thoughts in general about what you've observed. This is a 68-year-old woman who interestingly developed pericarditis on a carbapaxitaxel pembro. Here's Dr. Isawai.
About 3 months into her maintenance treatment, she was admitted to the hospital with severe chest pain and shortness of breath. Imaging and workup showed fluid around the heart, and she was diagnosed with a pericarditis, had a pericardial window done, and was stabilized and optimized and sent home. I lost most of my hair until we got to the actual diagnosis that this is a pericarditis. I was just hitting my head to the wall, not knowing what exactly was going on.
Any questions for the faculty?
So other than the known side effects, which we're all getting adept at recognizing and treating, like the thyroiditis and the colitis, what other inflammatory or autoimmune conditions do the faculty see, and how do they typically manage them commonly in their practice using those agents?
So Matt, curious, have you seen cardiac complications of IOs, and any other comments on his questions about the spectrum of IO toxicity?
Yeah, I think, the carditis is a tricky one because the patient has pretty vague symptoms often, and I think you have to be vigilant looking for it. When we see these patients, they're going to have elevated troponins. They're often end up needing a biopsy and good cardiac expertise to try to sort out, is this related to therapy? Do I have to stop therapy at this point? The other one, that we see a lot of these myositis. So they're getting it, especially, their shoulder and back muscles are weakened, and the patients can become quite disabled. And again, great ASCO guidelines on how to manage all this, the steroid intervention. The tricky part is for those patients that are really getting good benefit and the disease starts to grow back when you're stopping, and traditionally it's been something you might have stopped. Do you try it again or do you try an alternate therapy? I'd be interested in Katie's opinion of that. But these are tricky situations, and thankfully a lot of these patients that suffer this these complications are having good response to their therapy.
Right. That's so frustrating.
Katie,
I have thoughts. But I'm going to say them quickly. I have so many thoughts. I have this patient right now. She's was on an IO on a clinical trial. And it's what you said, Matt. You have to your antennas have to be up all the time for things that we didn't used to think about. She's doing great. She's a terrible cancer responding to this trial I had her on. She's like, I'm doing great. She sees me from another state and she's like, yeah, I was lifting my giant suitcase into the car. My shoulder hurts today. I'm like, well, I'll give you some ibuprofen upstairs. Or some acetaminophen is what I said. And I sent her upstairs. And then I'm like charting 30 minutes later. I'm like, well, maybe I'm going to send a troponin because it was her left shoulder. I'm going to send a troponin. So I added it to the morning labs. That thing came back 300. So I like went upstairs. I'm like, hold the drug. She's like, I feel fine. She had myocarditis. We got a cardiac MRI. Myocarditis mild, preserved EF, but definitely there. Treated with steroids. Got it to resolve. Put her back on the drug, monitored the troponins, made sure it didn't go up. We ramped it back up. And she was doing great again. Came in with hepatitis. And so now we're done. And she's getting better and she's going to be okay. But no, I'm not going to retreat her again ever since. So I did try and reintroduce. And it's just a no-go. So these are such complicated scenarios. Your antennas have to be up. Like I send troponins all the time now for anything that they complain about to make sure I'm not missing myocarditis, myositis, and then we work it up with our cardio oncologist. It's just I think I just missed a lot in the past. I mean, it had to have been happening, and we just attributed it to failure to thrive, maybe. But yeah, I mean, I've tried to rechallenge, and sometimes I get away with it, and sometimes in this case, again, we responded and she's okay, but she's not going to get another IO.
So, Matt, a question I've been asking ever since I started hearing about checkpoint inhibitors, and I don't know if there's anything new on this or what your thoughts are about it, which is there any correlation between autoimmune toxicity and treatment benefit?
Well, certainly, you know, anecdotally, and I know there's been some studies about that, and I don't know if how much there's, you know, what the truth is behind that. It's just not controlled well enough for me to be convinced, but I would say anecdotally, a lot of people report that, boy, the patient was doing so well on this therapy, now has the autoimmune problem. Katie, do you have any thoughts there?
I think it's correlated. I think when these the patients have these big side effects, you know, I'm not planning on starting anything. I'm going to follow her, and I bet you nothing's going to grow for a long time. I mean, I'm going to follow her closely. I'm not going to be blasé about it. But sometimes you get these big toxicities. It takes a bit to get them fine again. Months have gone by and not one thing has happened on that CT scan. You have to be careful, but you don't just have to blow to some next therapy and kind of wait, because they have some immune response that can maintain their disease stability sometimes for a really long time. So I tend to try that first and just leave people alone, closely monitor them, because I do think it correlates a lot of the time with clinical benefit, but I wouldn't say that is, you know, Katie's rule. I think it's just something I think about.
I have a really odd case. You had bone marrow transplant and metastatic endometrial cancer to follow not too long after transplant. One dose of checkpoint, all goes away. She had bad side effects, obviously, with her transplant with graft versus host, but now 2.5 years has not recurred with one dose. So that's all she got to treat this metastatic endometrial cancer. So I, you know, it's cool stuff.
Yeah.
I guess IOs cool do scary. Work sometimes in endometrial cancer. So I want to ask, we talked about TDXD. You already've got mirvetuximab out there and tisotumab in terms of ADC, but I can't say I'm tremendously surprised, but I don't think we've talked about the top idea of TROP2 ADCs, Katie, in endometrial cancer. You can imagine I feel like we talk about that all day long in breast cancer, because we have actually two different TROP2 ADCs approved, sacituzumab govitecan and datopotamab deruxtecan that you see there. And also another agent that I think is approved in China, SAC-TMT. Katie, do you see TROP2 in endometrial cancer? And any thoughts about where these ADCs are? I think we're going to see some data at ESMO on this.
We are going to see a little data at ESMO. So TROP2, like every other solid tumor, is very common, the tumor-associated antigen. It's almost ubiquitous that you'll have some. And then there's various levels. And then, of course, there's a lot of ambiguity around whether or not the level of TROP2 matters. And we'll continue to sort of discuss that. So endometrial definitely expresses TROP2, and the different histologies have different levels of high, medium, and low based on what assay you're looking at. It probably for endometrial, TROP2 was one of the first ADCs kind of out of the gate of interest. And there's in fact two phase 3 studies that are well underway. In fact, one I believe is either near has completed accrual with sacituzumab trametican versus investigator's choice. The other one is sacituzumab govitecan versus investigator's choice in second line recurrent uterine cancer. Prior immunotherapy is required. So those will likely result, I bet you, next year. I think that we could estimate maybe a late 26 readout on those, and we'll see. And then there's just, like every solid tumor, a tidal wave of ADCs coming right behind them. We have a B7-H4 in a phase 3 now, Huxisam, and there's others coming that aren't quite in public domain yet. So it's going to get crowded. Oh, here it is.
So here's one of them. Maybe there's others, I think, in terms of B7-H4 targeted ADCs. Matt, any comment on that? You know, it's interesting, and again, with the TROP2, you see kind of a different toxicity. Even though the efficacy data looks the same, you see different toxicity profiles. Data, you see mucositis, which you don't see with SASI. SASI, you see the neutropenia, and the tiramatecan, the SAC-TMT, maybe it's in the middle. Any thoughts about these new ADCs and whether they're going to land in endometrial cancer, Matt?
I think so. You know, we had one of the TROP trials open, and, you know, anecdotally, the very excited and sad the trial accrued so quickly. Area is growing. Obviously, keeping our ophthalmologists busy when we have a lot of eye checks and things for the different agents. But you're right, different toxicities for each of these agents, and it really does make it exciting and a lot of opportunity for clinical trial opportunities for our patients.
So we're going to squeeze in one more case, an interesting question here in terms of other mutations that we're seeing in this patient. This woman actually had autoimmune colitis as a result of getting IO chemotherapy with Carbogem and Pembro. But here's Dr. Giffey's questions about this 73-year-old lady.
This is a 73-year-old lady with metastatic endometrial cancer, MSI stable, HER2 negative. Just a couple of months ago, she developed a single pelvic node biopsy-confirmed disease again, and it was the only site of disease, and she didn't want any more chemo, so we excised it. The path is now being called serous carcinoma of the endometrium. Tumor cells are positive for ER, weak to moderate in 80% of cells. She's currently off therapy per her wishes and is being monitored with serial scans. So my question with this woman is, since she wants to avoid chemotherapy altogether, would you try an AI now, even though this disease doesn't sound particularly hormone sensitive based on its behavior? She declined anything, but I think I could talk her into an AI the next time I see her. When I ran NGS on her most recent tumor specimen, she does have PI3 kinase and FGFR mutations. I'm not positive of the kinds of mutations that respond to the targeted inhibitors we use in other diseases, but I was curious if the investigators have tried to target these sort of last lines of therapy with off-label usage. And then my last question is, in patients who develop severe immune-related adverse events like colitis and cannot be rechallenged, do you ever use lenvatinib alone or lenvatinib with a different immune checkpoint inhibitor? Because she hasn't seen a TKI yet.
So, Katie, one of my favorite presentations coming up in Berlin there with ESMO is capivasertib, the AKT inhibitor in prostate cancer. Can you imagine, you know, the oncologists have enough trouble trying to use it in breast cancer, or urologists maybe going to use a PIK3 inhibitor like Capi. But anyhow, any thoughts about this case? Can you target PIK3? Can you target FGFR in endometrial cancer?
There are studies for FGFR3, so I need to know which FGFR it is. There are studies for FGFR3. That's mainly a bladder and cervix finding, but there are some agents there, so I'd want to know that. I also want to know, now that it's serous, what her TP53 mutation status is, because that wasn't stated, and whether or not they retested for HER2 on this specimen. So there's some things that I don't really know. PIK3 has been tough to target thus far, although I will say in phase one, there are a few agents, I haven't quite presented yet, but with particular isotypes, we are starting to see some pretty striking benefit. So I would say thus far disappointing, but stay tuned because some of these are looking really good and not causing the hyperglycemia and other problems that we saw with the PIK3 inhibitors. So I actually think that there's going to be a potential role for them, but it's particular isotypes. It's just not like I got a PIK3, I'm going to use this. And with a serous tumor, I bet you the PIK3 is not really driving the bus here. And so I would probably be coming at this with an ADC, number one. I should be coming at it with some kind of antibody-drug conjugate. And on a clinical trial, thinking about things like CDK2 inhibitors or CHK1/2 inhibitors. Prexasertib is, used to be called Prexasertib, is the Acrivon medicine that's in clinical trials for this population. So I'd be looking more that direction rather than trying to target the PIK3 here, as I don't think it's going to help her. And I definitely don't think an aromatase inhibitor will make a difference here personally. You're just treating. I think I'd be treating me, but not the patient. What do you think, Matt? What are your thoughts on her?
Yeah, especially with no evidence of disease currently, I think you're just adding toxicity and unlikely to help. Now, I agree with you about the P53 because P53 seems to be a reasonable marker about who might benefit from endocrine therapy in endometrial cancer. Those wild-type patients may have a little more likelihood, even though it's called serous under the microscope.
Yeah.
And so being suspicious and having that all reviewed, I think, is a good idea. But I think everything else spot on. Yeah.
So, Katie and Matt, thank you so much for working with us today. I want to say especially a special thanks to the docs who presented cases. You know, we appreciate that so much, that people are willing to put out their own treatment in front of the world, so to speak, and see what people think about it. But it's so valuable to do that. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Katie. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Have a good
one. Thanks so much.